Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Barack knows the American dream because he's lived it. And he wants everyone in this country, everyone, to have the same opportunity, no matter who we are or where we're from or what we look like or who we love.
Well, one measure of Michelle Obama's success last night, her Democratic convention speech drew 28,000 tweets per minute, nearly double what Mitt Romney's speech inspired, according to the social media site Mashable. So let's start there and bring in maybe the perfect journalist to understand the speech in context, Jody Cantor, New York Times correspondent and author of the book The Obamas, now out in paperback. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
And let me begin this way. Michelle Obama gave an incredibly moving speech that I have no doubt she genuinely believed most every word of. Everybody I know was crying. I was crying. But I want to talk about it as a masterful piece of political rhetoric. You think it was, right?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you posed it that way. The thing I kept thinking about during the speech was money and class. That speech last night was really about two men. It was about Barack Obama, who of course she talked about, and it was about a man she never named. It was about Mitt Romney. Nearly every line of that speech, when you go through the text, is about economic struggle. It was almost as if she was saying, forget that my husband and I live in the White House. Forget that we're actually pretty wealthy ourselves. Forget the beautiful, fancy clothes we wear. We are everyday Americans. We are you. There were lines about student debt. Very funny line. We were young. We were in love. We were in debt. Lines about rusted cars. Lines about Barack Obama's old coffee table that he pulled out of a dump.
So why don't you hold it right there for a second, because you happen to be keying right in on the clip that I pulled that I think is kind of, you know, the central organizing principle of the speech boiled down to 60 seconds, in which she ties her and Barack's personal story to the central reelection campaign theme.
When it comes to giving our kids the education they deserve, Barack knows that, like me and like so many of you, he never could have attended college without financial aid. And believe it or not, when we were first married, our combined monthly student loan bill was actually higher than our mortgage. Yeah, we were so young, so in love, and so in debt. And that's why Barack has fought so hard to increase student aid and keep interest rates down, because he wants every young person to fulfill their promise and be able to attend college without a mountain of debt. So in the end, for Barack, these issues aren't political. They're personal, because Barack knows what it means when a family struggles.
So, Jody Cantor, there it is, everything except the line about rust, financial aid, student loans, mortgage payments. We feel your pain because, subtext, we weren't born with silver spoons in our mouths like Mitt Romney. That's the idea, right?
And notice the really sophisticated division of labor on behalf of the Obama campaign, because Obama advisors and people like Joe Biden have been roughing up Mitt Romney. They've said that he is an insensitive, out-of-touch guy, a throwback. He's clueless about the struggles of ordinary Americans. They've dumped mounds of opposition research about his work at Bain and his personal financial situation out there. The First Lady didn't need to do any of that. She could come in as the elegant, gracious, uplifting figure and just talk about her husband, in implicit contrast to Mitt Romney.
So I want to compare that stretch we just played to Ann Romney's attempt to do basically the same thing in her speech. So here's a part of that from last week. This is also about a minute. And the difference to me, something to listen for, is that Michelle's was in the first person, Ann's is in the third.
I have been all across this country, and I know a lot of you guys. And I have seen and heard stories of how hard it is to get ahead now. You know what? I've heard your voices. They've said to me, I'm running in place and we just can't get ahead. Sometimes I think that late at night, if we were all silent for just a few moments and listened carefully, we could hear a collective sigh from the moms and dads across America who made it through another day and know that they'll make it through another one tomorrow. But in the end of that day moment, they just aren't sure how.
They just aren't sure how. Jody, I thought Ann Romney did very well there, actually, but she had to put it in the third person or the second person, you. I've heard their stories, third person. Sometimes they aren't sure how they'll make it through another day. And maybe that's a subtle difference, since she sounded like she got it. But I think the Obamas were banking in no small measure on the difference between first person and second or third person language last night. Do you think?
Absolutely. And look, Ann Romney did deliver a very impressive speech. It was very effective. And yet she does have a class problem. I've seen this with her over the years. I was listening to her speak in late 2007 in South Carolina, and she told the story of how much people loved her husband's governorship. But what she said is that she was having a manicure in Boston while he was governor, and the manicurist, who was a Vietnamese immigrant, started breaking down in tears over how much Mitt Romney had helped her. And Ann Romney told the story with, you know, without a lot of self-awareness, right? I mean, it's a little lady of the manor telling a story about a low-paid manicurist breaking down over in tears over how much the governor has helped her.
By the way, we have some breaking news about the convention just coming in right now. According to Politico, they've announced that President Obama's speech for Thursday night has been moved from the stadium in Charlotte indoors into the Time Warner Center, where he will give it now because of weather forecasts. Did you hear that? Had you heard that yet?
Well, everybody's been talking about it, and I think it's smart because, honestly, political journalism aside, one of the main themes here has been the rain. The logistics here are really complicated, getting from one place to the next because of security, and they keep confiscating everybody's umbrellas, which are apparently a security threat, and then there are these drenching, almost biblical rains. And so delegates were going to have to get to this arena as early as 10 hours before the speech, and it's an open-air arena, and they were not going to let umbrellas in. So I think you had a recipe for some very unhappy Democrats. There are elderly people, people in wheelchairs here. And then they also risked the possibility that the president could be speaking to a sodden, half-empty stadium because people would have been intimidated by the weather and not shown up. So I think it's a wise move.
Is it also about size then? Is it the stadium? Is it that the stadium has more seats, and because there is an enthusiasm gap compared to 4 years ago, they were afraid of it looking half empty, even if the weather's okay?
The weather may have been a good excuse for them to move this to a smaller venue, because the stadium is huge. It's got like 77,000 seats. And so were they really going to be able to fill that, especially when, you know, as I mentioned, it's not like you can just show up for the speech. You have to come for hours and hours and hours. This is definitely a safer approach. And remember, conventions are about avoiding risk, right? Things have been going really well for the Democrats so far. They don't want to risk anything that's off message.
Listeners, your reaction so far to the Democratic convention speeches, Michelle Obama, Julian Castro, the keynote speaker, anybody else who you may have heard last night. We'll talk in a few minutes with Jody Cantor, author of The Obamas, about some of the other speeches and the sweep of the entire evening for people who were watching longer than just the 10 o'clock hour. But any of your impressions, Democrats welcome to call in, Republicans welcome to call in, independents and undecideds, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Jody, let me make one more comparison, and this is going to be 2 minutes of tape, so everybody get comfortable in your chairs or wherever you are. The Tuesday night headliner this week to the Tuesday night headliner last week, Michelle Obama as compared with Chris Christie.
If farmers and blacksmiths could win independence from an empire, If immigrants could leave behind everything they knew for a better life on our shores, if women could be dragged to jail for seeking the vote, if a generation could defeat a depression and define greatness for all time, if a young preacher could lift us to the mountaintop with his righteous dream, And if proud Americans can be who they are and boldly stand at the altar with who they love, then surely, surely, we can give everyone in this country a fair chance at that great American dream. More than anything else, that is the story of this country, the story of unwavering hope grounded in unyielding struggle.
The greatest lesson that Mom ever taught me, though, was this one. She told me there would be times in your life when you have to choose between being loved and being respected. Now, she said to always pick being respected. She told me that love without respect was always fleeting, but that respect could grow into real and lasting love. Now, of course, she was talking about women. But I've learned over time that it applies just as much to leadership. In fact, I think that advice applies to America more than ever today. You see, I believe we have become paralyzed by our desire to be loved.
So, Jody Kantor, I think this is really a stark comparison on the role of government. It's yes, we can versus no, we can't. And which side do you want to place your money on for a better future?
Absolutely. You know, although I do think that Chris Christie is on to something, which is that the way we treat our president and first lady, it sort of is like we are all married to the Obamas. I mean, we're talking to WNYC listeners now, so there are probably a lot of Democrats. I mean, the things that New York Democrats say about President Obama are a lot like the things they say about their spouses. You know, he's doing that thing again. I'm annoyed today. Why does he do that? I don't understand. But then you know, New York Democrats watch the Republican convention and watch the other guy and say, wait a second, I'm really happy about who we're married to right now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think you're on to something fundamental about the rhetoric of this campaign, which is that this whole fiscal discipline thing is just a hard sell for Republicans. I mean, I ask voters all the time when I meet with them, I say, is it really true that the deficit keeps you up at night? Like, in your hierarchy of worries, the things that trouble you when you're trying to fall asleep at 11 o'clock at night, are you really thinking about the national deficit? And so I think it's going to be a very tough sell.
So when we continue in a minute, we'll start to take your calls, but I want to kind of not turn the page, but take this to another level, because as well as Michelle Obama may have done last night for swing state America and even red America with that speech, it definitely does not a successful convention make. So we will continue in a minute with Jody Kantor, New York Times correspondent and author of The Obamas, now out in paperback. More clips from Michelle Obama's speech from last night and your calls that are coming in at 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us.
As I got to know Barack, I realized that even though he had grown up all the way across the country, he'd been brought up just like me.
Just like me, Jody Kantor. Subtext, he's an American, remember?
You know, that is, I really don't think Barack Obama would be president of the United States without Michelle Obama. And, you know, I'll even up the ante and say without Malia and Sasha Obama. From the beginning of his political career, they've really stood for the fact that this guy who had an exotic background and an unusual name and is African-American is this wholesome dad, this family man. And that has come up really in every race that Barack Obama has run, definitely back to the 2004 Senate race.
So as well as Michelle Obama did last night, I want to take this, as I said before the break, to the next level of political analysis, because this speech does not a successful convention make. People may swoon and cry, but that speech doesn't get anyone a job. It doesn't help any small business person get a loan. It doesn't save Medicare, and it doesn't reduce the debt. And millions of people probably wiped away their tears around 11:30 last night and said, I really, really like her, and she really, really gets me. But I still don't know if Barack Obama has the best skills to turn the economy around. You think?
Well, in some ways, I think the Obama people wish that they could go with the kind of Michelle Obama mood music all the way, right? Because the ideal thing about being First Lady is that you don't really have to get into the mix on economic policies, and you don't really have to sort of answer in a detailed way for, you know, gee, why did the president underestimate the economic problems in the beginning of 2009?
But the strength of the Republican convention was on its kind of bracing economic realism, the Chris Christie, we have to say no, the Paul Ryan, we're going to save Medicare, but we need to deal with the debt before we become Europe, and things like that, wasn't it?
Well, the next stage of speeches is from Elizabeth Warren and Bill Clinton, and these are, for my money, the two best economic storytellers in the Democratic Party. You know, something that we have noticed for a long time about Barack Obama, I remember sitting in a New York Times meeting in 2008 talking about this, is that he's never really had a strong economic message, meaning a way of taking his economic policies and unifying them under a coherent set of ideas, saying this is an easily understandable, clear roadmap for what I'm doing on the economy. Bill Clinton and Elizabeth Warren are fantastic at that. And they're also really good at sort of telling what they see as the story of what the Republicans did to the economy. I think they're going to remind us again and again tonight that the 2008 economic collapse basically happened, on George Bush's watch, even though they continued into Barack Obama's tenure. And I think they'll also be telling us about a lot of the things that the Obama administration has tried to do to address them, even small things like modifying the college loan program. Now, the funny thing is that in private, Elizabeth Warren and Bill Clinton, I think, have very interesting critiques of Obama economic policymaking, and each of them would have liked to have seen Obama do slightly different things, talk about them in different ways. But, you know, they'll be all positive, and they'll be really better spokespeople for this issue that I think the First Lady or almost any other surrogate could be. You know, the bigger question in my mind is really what the president will say Thursday night. I talked recently to David Axelrod, who said that the president's main focus in this campaign has been on the rhetorical challenge of making the case for reelection. And it's very difficult because, you know, the economy has really been stuttering. Although the president can point to his accomplishments, of course, he basically has to make an argument for unfinished business. And he has to make an argument that will excite Democrats enough to kind of light a spark, win independent voters, and yet one that will sound realistic and plausible. I mean, he can't go on stage on Thursday night and say, yes, we're going to pass a climate bill. It's just not tenable in an era when Republicans control the House.
Jody Kantor, my guest on WNYC, New York Times correspondent. And for those of you who might read the paper but don't notice the bylines, she's had these major articles day after day over the last week. The one on Michelle Obama's journey from reluctant spouse to campaign powerhouse and the enthusiastic hugs that she gives on the campaign trail. And the one about Obama himself the other day, and the one about how they were trying to warm up Mitt Romney with all these personal stories from Mormons at their convention last week. So Jody Kantor, very lead reporter on the conventions and the race right now, and she's the author of the book, The Obamas, which is just out in paperback. And Monique in Tarrytown, you're on WNYC. Hello, Monique.
Hi, I love your show. I wanted to comment, not comment, but ask. You know, for me, it was really striking the juxtaposition between Ted Kennedy, who I don't think he had college debt or he pulled furniture from a dumpster or had a rusty car, but he was able to have the empathy necessary for the compassion to think of the broader population. what is it that's different about the Romney wealth that would not let them have perhaps the empathy or compassion that it's really necessary to underscore sort of like the authentic voice, like, you know, we were there, you know, we struggled, you know, and as you mentioned earlier, forget about Costa del Sol, forget about the White House, forget about the nice clothes, but we were there, we're authentic. What's the difference between a Kennedy and a Romney?
Monique, that's such an interesting question. Thank you. Jody Cantor, what do you think?
There's a great story I'm trying to remember perfectly about Kennedy answering this very question. Somebody challenged him on that. I think it might have even been in the race with Romney, and he had some great answer that basically it was very honest. He said, you know, he said, I'll fact check it and tweet it and put it on Facebook later, but he said something like, you know, he acknowledged that he, you know, he wasn't exactly, you know, the guy who had been scrubbing floors, and yet he talked about what he really believed and what his priorities were. You know, I think the main difference, to answer your question, between a guy like Ted Kennedy and a guy like Mitt Romney is that Ted Kennedy is, I mean, he was a politician's politician, politician all the way, a kind of Bill Clinton-esque figure in his ability to relate to people, to understand a really wide spectrum of people, you know, loved people, had a kind of natural connection to them. You know, his family, of course, had a very strong sort of social justice streak. Mitt Romney has more difficulty as a retail politician. I mean, part of what's been so fascinating about his campaign is that you look at him and you say, well, why is this guy who's so comfortable in the corporate world and actually doesn't even seem to like the political world that well or be especially terrific at its rituals, why does he want this? Why does he want to be a part of it? And look, I mean, the Romney campaign has tried to humanize their candidate, but they're only going so far. I mean, they don't pretend that their guy is the most natural connector or most effective spokesperson in the world. They basically say, you know, look, what we're really offering you is a guy who we believe can fix the economy.
I think on the Kennedys versus the Romneys, there's another piece that should be added, which is that from a Republican perspective, Edward Kennedy and the Kennedys in general were also out of touch with part of working class America. That as much as a lot of different kinds of ordinary Americans may feel the Romneys don't get them, there is a part of white working class America that really thinks Ted Kennedy in particular and the Kennedys in general do not get them and might even be hostile to them. And maybe they get something about poor black people. Maybe they romanticize that sector, that they're limousine liberals that are willing to take money out of the pockets of white working class people. And so there really is a class issue with the Kennedys for another swath of America than we've been talking about.
But what's so interesting, Brian, is the fact that the Romney people haven't really been able to take advantage of that, right? We don't have a Republican candidate who's more like a Chris Christie type who would represent a kind of, you know, blue-collar drive, you know, a Tim Pawlenty who would really speak for those voters. You know, I don't know that white working-class voters are the most natural match for Mitt Romney either.
Paul in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. Yeah, I was the highlight for me, one of the highlights last night was Deval Patrick's speech, and it sort of reminded me of the Chris Christie speech in which both sort of touted their successes in their own states, but then Deval Patrick had this, his most passionate part was a full-throated support of the president where that sort of lacked with the Christie speech, so I'd just love to hear your reaction to the Deval Patrick speech.
And let's first play, for people who didn't hear it, a speech that was highly praised by Democrats in the Twitter sphere as part of the whole sweep of this night that, I don't know, is definitely, you know, catnip for Democrats. We'll see how it plays with the rest of the country. But the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, 35 seconds.
This is the president who brought Osama bin Laden to justice, who ended the war in Iraq and is ending the war in Afghanistan. This is the president who ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so that love of country, not love of another, determines fitness for service, who made equal pay for equal work the law of the land. This is the president who saved the American auto industry from extinction, the American financial industry from self-destruction, the American economy from full-blown depression.
And in a way, Jody Kantor, that clip doesn't even do him justice, because that was from the emotional peak of the speech, late in the speech, and the way he built up to that was almost as powerful as the way Michelle Obama built and built her speech.
You know, and it's really a shame the way the conventions are shown on TV now. There is so much chatter by, you know, the cable commenters. They essentially put the speeches on mute when everybody but the sort of Michelle Obama and Chris Christie people are on. And it's a shame because some of the more minor speeches are really not so minor. They're so revealing. The ones that I thought were incredible at the Republican convention were the ones by the families that Mitt Romney helped in his Boston church. They were devastating stories. They were both stories about dead or dying children. And Mitt Romney performed these extraordinary acts of tenderness and kindness and generosity. And the parents themselves were telling these stories. And, you know, my colleague David Brooks said, you know, he couldn't maintain his composure during these speeches. They were so moving. And yet, you know, what do we watch on TV? 5 minutes later, we watch Clint Eastwood and the chair.
I know. And David Brooks also said that he was just mystified that they didn't put those folks in prime time, because if the goal was to humanize Mitt Romney, oh boy, did they do it in terms of him going out of his way as a caring individual, ministering to people who were physically or otherwise in need. And similarly, last night at the Democratic convention, I just want to mention the whole sweep of the evening. For those watching before Michelle, it was a whole string of powerful stories. The mother whose baby needed heart surgery and the Affordable Care Act guaranteed that there would be no lifetime insurance company cap if the child keeps needing medical care. Cory Booker and Deval Patrick gave those powerful personal political speeches. And the keynote address, which I guess was in prime time, just before Michelle's, from Julian Castro, mayor of San Antonio. It was also right in that vein. So I guess the message there was, if the Republicans were trying to paint Obama policies as a failure, here were people who were saying specifically, like that mother, how Obama policies like the Affordable Care Act have actually been successes in their personal lives, but very few Americans actually saw it.
You know, the one who most Americans did see, I think, who was very effective is the military mom who introduced Michelle Obama. I mean, Michelle Obama's speech then exploded and sort of took over. But that was actually a real moment. I mean, it was such a simple introduction and so heartfelt and extremely effective, I thought.
And you know what else I noticed last night? You mentioned the TV networks. I had been watching these speeches on the cable channels last week, but last night I checked in on ABC and NBC as Michelle's speech ended, and they hardly did any analysis. A couple of minutes, then off to your local 11 o'clock show, whatever it is. So a lot of America sees these speeches basically unspun by pundits and analysts, and I don't know who benefits from that, but it was striking to me how quickly ABC and NBC got right off the air.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the real fun of watching these speeches is not only just experiencing their emotion and argument, but they beg to be deconstructed. I mean, even if you're a Democrat and a huge Obama fan, you have to be a little skeptical about the stories they're telling. You have to see the sort of art of persuasion they're trying to use, the imagery, the word choices, the stuff that is not necessarily false, but is a little bit of a spin on the truth. One thing I'll mention is that, you know, Michelle Obama kept talking last night about how great it was that, you know, her husband wasn't the kind of guy who wanted to make a lot of money. He worked in all these low-paying jobs in Chicago. Well, let me tell you something. For years in Chicago, Michelle Obama complained to anybody who was listening that she really wanted her husband to get a more lucrative job. She had, you know, she had appreciation, but also limited patience for his, you know, his do-gooder quest, and, you know, wanted their family to have some economic security. But, this was part of what was fun and interesting and fascinating about reporting my book, because what's really happened to the Obamas in the last 4 years is that they've become politicians, right? They almost didn't need to in 2004 or 2008. They were so swept away by the enthusiasm that voters had for them. And yet, since they've gotten to the White House, they've both, in different ways, needed to learn to operate on a whole new level. And so, as I reported it, I kept hearing these kind of behind-the-scenes stories of what was happening to them. It was really about them kind of learning to master the art of politics. There was even a meeting in the Oval Office in October of 2010 where political advisors talked to them about the political potency of their marriage. They did a PowerPoint presentation. There were numbers. There were stats. And it was like, okay, you know, President, First Lady, your marriage is a really powerful political weapon. This is how people respond to it. This is how we're going to use it. So I just, you know, be savvy when you watch these conventions. Know that nothing is left to chance. Everything is calculated. Everything is sending a message.
Jody Kantor, New York Times correspondent at the Democratic Convention and author of the book, The Obamas, now out in paperback. Jody, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, more to come. WNYC. Again, the political breaking news from the convention in the last few minutes. President Obama's Thursday night address has now been moved indoors to the Time Warner Cable Arena due to weather forecasts, they say. The Thursday address was scheduled to be at Bank of America Stadium, an outdoor venue with more than 70,000 seats, but forecasts are predicting thunderstorms, forcing a last-minute change in venue. Here's how the Republicans are reacting to that change. They have issued a statement that says, quote, "Enthusiasm for President Obama is so low that he's being forced to downgrade his convention events left and right. First, the DNC had to cancel their opening event at Charlotte Motor Speedway due to low enthusiasm. Now President Obama is being forced to move his acceptance speech to a smaller venue just to avoid the embarrassment of speaking to an empty stadium. After 4 years of failure on the economy, it's clear that Americans are looking for actual solutions, not another speech full of empty promises." That from Matt Connelly, RNC spokesman, in reaction to this change of venue announcement that has come just within the hour. My next guest from the convention is working to keep enthusiasm high in the young adult vote. Aaron Smith is the co-founder and executive director of the Young Invincibles, a national group committed to mobilizing and expanding opportunities for young Americans between 18 and 34 years of age on issues like higher education, health care, and jobs. Aaron, hello. Welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So let me play you a clip of Paul Ryan from his convention speech. I think you can guess which one this is going to be, and ask you to put this together with the reaction to the change in venue that I just read from the RNC. Here's Paul Ryan.
College graduates should not have to live out their 20s in their childhood bedrooms, staring up at fading Obama posters and wondering when they can move out and get going with life.
Is this a challenge for your wing of the party?
Well, I think that's a statement that's getting a lot of attention on both sides. People are, I think it's something that resonates with people, is this concern that young adults who are pursuing that education, pursuing the American dream, are struggling when they get out. And, you know, I think that's something that both parties really should be talking about. So, you know, happy to hear that for sure.
What do you think about the change in venue? And is there some enthusiasm gap, avoidance of speaking to a half-empty 70,000-seat stadium in addition to the forecast of thunderstorms?
Well, I'll let the campaigns talk about that issue. You know, we're a nonpartisan youth advocacy group, but these issues about, you know, youth engagement, I think there's been a lot of talk about young people not coming out to vote in the same numbers this time. But I'm actually pretty hopeful. We're seeing an uptick in the enthusiasm. You know, young people were about 18% of the electorate in 2008, but they were actually 17% of the electorate in 2004. So I think it's a certainty that young people are going to be a major voting block, and those issues that they care about, whether it's student loans or youth unemployment or health care, are going to be you know, front and center in this election.
Our political reporter Anna Sale from itsafreecountry.org, our politics website, has been talking to delegates in Charlotte, and she met Daniel McNaughton, a 21-year-old from Florida, who will be voting for the first time in this election, but he remembers the enthusiasm of his peers in 2008. Listen.
In 2008, there was a lot of energy from youth, just because a lot of people were upset with Bush over the way the wars were going and the way the economy was going. Now everything's sort of calmed down. The economy's getting back up there, so there's less of the feel of urgency. It's gone.
So how do you get those voters back to the polls?
I mean, I think at this point you really have to focus on the issues that affect young people on a day-to-day basis. You know, this is the time to really explain what are these next 4 years going to look like for young Americans on these issues that we're hearing so much about. You know, student debt is now over $1 trillion. That's something that both sides have been talking about, but we're sort of looking for that comprehensive vision on how we deal with things like the cost of college. You know, youth unemployment is about twice the national average. Again, we're looking for, you know, a clear vision on that. I think spelling those things out is going to get young people motivated. And we've actually seen, you know, some degree of enthusiasm around specific issues. You look at the DREAM Act and many young immigrants who are really leading the charge on that movement. You look at Occupy Wall Street, again, which was often led by young people. We have seen young people get involved, and I'm hopeful, again, that you're going to see that again in this election.
The name of your group, Young Invincibles, was coined during the debate over the Affordable Care Act. It was used in sort of an ironic, derogatory sense to refer to the thousands of young adults who choose not to have health insurance. But by including the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act, which really targets young, healthy people who are choosing not to buy insurance, didn't Obama give some credence to this sentiment or to the, you know, did he, here he is forcing something that's unpopular on part of his base, young adults?
Well, the way that, you know, it's important for people to have all the facts on the mandate, for example, you know, how much is it going to cost? Actually, many people, if insurance is more than 8% of your income, are actually going to be exempt from the mandate. But it's important to understand the mandate is part of this broader package. There's 20 million uninsured young adults. About 8 million of them are going to qualify for Medicaid expansion. About 9 million of them will actually qualify for exchanges and these subsidies that's going to provide forms of insurance and affordable insurance that they've never had before. That works because of this whole system where everyone's buying in, everyone's participating. We're not getting people who go to the emergency room without insurance that the hospital has to pick up the bill. That's how we create a comprehensive system where everyone gets covered. So that's why we've supported it. We already see, for example, with the letting your stay on your parents' plan at 26, over 3 million young people have gained insurance. Young people are the only age group in the country that have actually seen insurance rates go up, and that's directly as a result of the Affordable Care Act. But some of the most important things are yet to come.
Aaron Smith, Executive Director of the Young Invincibles, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer with you, and now from the Democratic Convention, former Virginia Congressman Tom Perriello. He now runs the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Congressman, welcome back. Hello.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So I heard Michelle Obama's speech, in addition to a moving testimonial about her husband, as a powerful argument for the positive role of government in this country. Did you hear it that way?
I really did. I mean, I think it was a reclaiming of the American dream and the idea that some things like a strong public education system and making college affordable are central to that American dream. And yes, some of that does involve a role of government. You know, my father grew up very poor in West Virginia and was able to make it to the University of Virginia and become a pediatrician and was able to see me make it to Congress. And I think, you know, when you think about various supports along the way, obviously it's about individuals driving and wanting to live out their dreams. But the idea of investing in things like education and infrastructure are an important part of that. And I think she, you know, cut through the politics of that and got right to a story that every American understands. Every American understands that idea of wanting to know that their kids are going to be able to live a better life than them, and certainly giving them the education they need is an important part of that.
After the stimulus, the TARP, and the health care law, and then the backlash from the Tea Party and the 2010 election, do you see this whole election in a way as a crossroads with respect to the role of government in our lives?
Well, I would put it a little differently, but I do think you're right about the crossroads. I think the conversation we've been having for 25 years is what's the proper size of government, and instead now we're discussing how fair should the economy be. And the answer is people want the economy to be fair. They want a chance to have a fair shot and a chance to live the American dream. And what we realized was the government conversation was about means, not ends. It was one piece of it. So it was narrowing the debate in important ways, particularly at a time of global competitiveness, where we have to have, as part of a fair economy, an answer to how are we going to outcompete China and India and other places. And the answer is we're not going to do it by cutting education spending and cutting infrastructure spending. That's crazy. You know, Mark Warner was on TV the other day, a very successful businessman, saying this just make the Romney-Ryan plan makes no sense from a business perspective. So I think this is a new conversation about economic fairness. And I think that the change hasn't come from the Beltway. It came from the streets of Ohio and Wisconsin. It came from middle and working class families across the country saying to Washington, saying to both parties, you guys don't get it. You don't get how deep this recession has been. You don't get how much we've adjusted to a new normal about economic insecurity. And I think one party, the Democrats, heard that. It took a couple years, but heard it. And the other party hasn't. And so I think what you see in these two conventions is a difference between one that's trying to speak to that new economic reality, the working and middle class, and put forward a positive vision. And I think that's what was so exciting last night to a lot of independent voters who are tuning out the negative ads is, okay, here are people willing to say this is what they believe in. They believe in this promise of the American dream and social mobility.
But looking back at the last 4 years, does the backlash against the stimulus and the health care law and the concern over the deficit indicate that the Democratic Party in Washington does have a different view of the role of government in our lives than many Americans do?
I think what most Americans are asking is, what does this mean for me and my family? And when one side is saying, hey, we're going to make sure that your kids get a good education, that you're not one pink slip away from losing your health insurance, and the other side is saying we're going to increase taxes on the middle class by $2,000 a year, we're going to make sure that the current retirees pay $11,000 more, and people in my generation, Generation X, will pay $240,000 more over the course of my retirement, under the Romney-Ryan Medicare plan. When I'm still carrying student loans, and I'm a guy with a couple of Yale degrees and a former member of Congress, and I've still got student loans, you know, the idea of adding on to that $240,000 more of expenses in my retirement is not a message from the other side. What they're saying is, you may have worked hard and played by the rules, but now we're going to pull the rug out from under you. So I think it's just incredibly out of touch. To talk about the stimulus, there's a new book out, and I think it's right, which is that it'll go down in history as one of the great legislative acts preventing a depression, probably the only time in history a legislative body has moved with the speed to prevent a depression. You see now the very people who have been so much against the stimulus, not only having gone and asked for money for themselves, we can play that politics game, but they're actually freaking out about the fiscal cliff at the end of the year, which means that they're essentially admitting that what we did with the stimulus prevented a depression and kept weak but real growth going, and now that we can't go back on that. So the very people who are most adamantly against this are basically begging that we not reverse that course at the end of the year. History usually doesn't allow you to answer what if, but Europe did take the Republican approach. One of the great ironies of this campaign is the Republicans keep trying to accuse the Democrats of being European in some way, but it was the Republicans that wanted to take the approach of Europe, and it's been, the austerity approach, I think, has been a disaster over there. And that's why, in many ways, our growth is being impeded by Europe, not vice versa.
Of course, the Republicans would say the big threat of recession from the fiscal cliff is that a number of taxes would go up, but we'll all have that debate in the coming months as we head toward that cliff. Tom Perriello, my guest.
But keep in mind that 40% of the stimulus was tax cuts. So those are not actually things at odds with each other.
Tom Perriello, former Virginia congressman, now head of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. You mentioned the Romney-Ryan Medicare plan. Paul Ryan, in his speech, emphasized that he and Mitt Romney get the difference between saving Medicare and destroying Medicare, and their plan for vouchers, what they would call premium support, is to save Medicare, not destroy it. So do you at least accept that the election is about two different visions of saving Medicare, not about keeping it versus killing it?
You know, it depends on what the definition of Medicare is. If Medicare is a guaranteed benefit of retirement health security, then no. That's what they're getting rid of. And what I think a lot of
which they would say people could use their vouchers to buy into traditional Medicare or not, so it's just more choice.
Right, but on those very terms, as you know, that means it's not guaranteed anymore. I mean, that's the essence of Medicare and Social Security, is a guaranteed benefit. It's a difference between there are certain things you invest in your life trying to maximize your return, and there are certain things where you buy insurance and you're buying a social insurance program. I'm paying into Medicare to be guaranteed that health benefit when I retire because I've paid into it, and he's saying, no, you're not going to get that. You're going to get a coupon. So I think it's absolutely the essence of not understanding how most people experience Medicare. For very well-off folks, Medicare and Social Security are kind of a bonus. For the vast majority of Americans, they are the guarantee that you're going to be able to age with dignity in terms of a minimum income and health coverage. When you remove that, you are removing the very promise of Medicare itself. So no, these aren't two versions of saving Medicare. I would reject that. I would say it's one that's trying to save Medicare and the other that, I mean, and let's face it, from Ryan's perspective, he ideologically is opposed to the very concept. And I think that's not being unfair. I think that's being fair to at least his claim of intellectual roots. You can't be an Ayn Randian scholar and believe that Medicare should exist. It's anathema to his perspective. And rather than defending that position and saying, sure, I don't think Medicare was a good idea and here's how we phase it out, I think that would be an intellectually honest conversation and we could have it. And again, people are entitled to that opinion and we'd be happy to have that debate.
During the First Lady's speech, people may have swooned and cried and felt inspired, but that speech doesn't get anyone a job. It doesn't help any small business person get a loan. It doesn't save Medicare, and it doesn't reduce the debt. And millions of people might have wiped away their tears around 11:30 last night and said, I really, really like her, and she really, really gets me. But the polls still show that people think Mitt Romney has better skills for turning around the economy. So given the issues facing the country, is Michelle Obama's speech totally relevant?
Totally. I don't think anyone thinks the entire campaign is going to be boiled down to that speech. I think it was incredibly moving, and I do think voters asked the question, who gets me, who has my back? And I think she gave an incredibly powerful speech last night that immediately cut across race and class and educational lines and got to basic human experience. But I also think she bridged it to policy. And the fact is there are policy differences. And, you know, she made that case. So I think there were a lot of folks last night who said, okay, this is a woman who's lived the kind of economic struggles that my family faces, and they've translated that into everything from why they thought it was important to save General Motors to why we should be making college more affordable as well as career and skills training. So I think it's the translation to policy. I think voters are smart and are going to ask those questions, and I think if they look at the whole of this week and really more importantly of the last 3 years, they're going to judge based on policy.
President,
I think that's one of the
Well, I was going to ask, President Clinton speaks tonight, and one of his most famous lines toward his second term was, the era of big government is over, as he sought to balance the budget. Can we embrace that line and Barack Obama's vision at the same time?
Sure. I mean, I think what both have talked about is wanting effective government and smart government and wanting a really strong private sector and nonprofit sector. When you think about the work that both of them have done in their personal life in poor communities and elsewhere, we understand that faith-based communities are going to be part of the solution and the philanthropic sector, that businesses being able to hire people is an important part of it. And yes, government has a role to play from leveling the playing field to trying to have a competitiveness strategy. Every other industrialized country in the world has a national competitiveness strategy, and it's been tough for the United States to do that because of how broken our politics are. So I think, you know, in a business, you understand the difference between an investment and an expense. expenditure. In your home, you understand that. If you go out, you know, tonight, you watch the NFL game, you get some beers and some burgers, all power to you. Nobody thinks that's an investment. That's an expenditure. If you took that same money and weatherized your home, or be a little more than that, you know, that's an investment that's going to return. Within our government sector, I think understanding the difference between where we're making an investment in future competitiveness and where we're just spending money out the door is an important distinction that both President Clinton and President Obama have made. I think, you know, you will see those arguments made tonight and made very effectively.
From the Democratic Convention in Charlotte, former Virginia Congressman Tom Perriello. He now runs the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. More to come from the Democratic Convention this week and elsewhere, coming up in the second hour of our show. And don't forget our convention coverage tonight. It begins at 7 o'clock with a call-in that I'll be hosting for WNYC listeners and callers from public radio stations, mostly in swing states. And it continues with Amy Eddings and our whole news team through the hour.